Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
TV.
On the radio.
Roll it there, Colette.
Hey, how you doing?
Bazinga.
Well, I didn't expect the kind of Spanish Inquisition.
One for everybody in the audience.
It's going to be legendary.
You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Jeremy Thorpe is elected leader of the Liberal Party.
He was heaven.
You're the youngest man to lead a British political party in more than a century.
Careful now, I'm not sure any boy's worth ending up in prison for.
I was a victim.
My little bunny.
It is alleged that Thorpe and Mr. Scott began a homosexual affair.
That's me.
Peter Taylor accused.
On the telly.
There you go. That's a very English scandal. It's on Sundays, 9 p.m. on BBC One. And I would say, James, that it is a very English scandal. It's almost the quintessential English scandal because it is closeted gay men having affairs who were, you know, went to public school and then ended up in the House of Commons with a bit of plotting to murder people thrown in.
And a dead dog, I think, along the way. And I'd never heard of it, honestly.
It was years ago.
It was 1975, I think, is when the case took place, or it's certainly 1970s anyway. But the first episode is, I think, it takes place from kind of 1965 to 1968, maybe, which is admittedly long before my vintage. So I'd never heard of it. But I'm not 100% sold on it as a drama for a couple of reasons. But I did also find it very entertaining at the same time. So there's real kind of powerhouse of British TV drama behind it in the sense that it's written by Russell T. Davis, who people will know as a writer of many, many things, and directed by Stephen Frears, who is another name people would know, and starring Hugh Grant as Jeremy Thorpe and Ben Whishaw as Norman Scott, nay, Joseph, his lover, Bunny. Yeah. And it obviously tells the story, as you laid out, of the leader of the Liberal Party getting embroiled in a conspiracy to murder his lover, who he was worried was going to out him, essentially, and destroy his career. And it's a three-part, one-hour drama, you know, in the sense it's going to be on for the next two Sunday nights. And the BBC does this kind of thing exceptionally well. You know, this is a period drama because it's 1960s and 70s. And they are sort of unparalleled when it comes to period drama, although we would usually just think of period drama being Elizabethan or, Georgian, Austen, something like that. I found it kind of oddly, so they went for a very comic line in it, in the sense that a lot of the stuff is played for laughs. And I have complained in the past about shows like Westworld not having enough jokes in it, that it's very po-faced. But I think this is sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, that this is too much joking going on. Like, it's a lot of very posh, upper-class, stiff upper-lipped British men talking a load of crap, you know, and like all winking, you know, winking almost to the point of like Carry On-esque, like, you know, O Matron style, right, histrionics. And I don't think it necessarily paints particularly well the sort of sinister side to all of this, in the sense that my reading of the drama, which is not, you know, is based purely on the hour of television I've seen. I've not read anything about the affair. I don't know anything about the history really at all. But to me, it was really, I mean, it's quite creepy. Like, it's about this older man, Jeremy Thorpe, maybe in his 40s, 50s, I'm not sure, but who has this younger man completely and utterly at his beck and call and in his thrall, and who exercises this great power over him to manipulate him to, you know, some very unfortunate ends or attempts at very unfortunate ends. And I thought it was really kind of like, it was playing this completely and utterly for laughs without any sort of pinch of salt about how serious kind of what's going on here actually is. And I thought it was like, it kind of totally felt like something that was planned and approved and produced entirely before the kind of Me Too movement came out and everyone sort of took a step back and looked at these kind of power dynamics in a more sort of knowing sense or knowing way. And I thought that the drama completely overlooked any of that side of it. Now, it was all very charming, right? Because it's got these plummy British guys doing plummy English roles really nicely and well. And Hugh Grant who we know, I guess, mostly as a rom-com star, has aged out of that role, right? He can no longer be, he can't be a foppish, stuttering dandy anymore.
So is he actually, because that's, is Hugh Grant entering a period in his career where it's a something of a golden period of his career where it's all character acting he's doing now, and he doesn't have to do what he previously did, was just like act like Hugh Grant?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's a bit of a Colin Firth move in the sense, you know, Colin Firth was kind of a, you know, a romantic lead as well, until suddenly he aged up, got a bit more mature, and then won an Oscar, right? So I think you're going to see that from Hugh Grant, and I saw all the reviews of this were glowing of him, and I do think he performs it very well. All of my faults with it are from the kind of structure of the story and the production rather than any of the performances, which I think are uniformly really, really good. Although actually seemingly Norman Scott, who I think is still alive and spent a lot of time in Ireland because part of it is set in Dublin, reportedly, according to The Guardian anyway, did not like Ben Whishaw's performance of him at all, considering it to be very like mincing and effeminate, which I don't know. I mean, I can't say if that's true or not, but he seemingly didn't like it. I thought both performances were well observed and assured. Hugh Grant particularly gets all of the charm because he is this witty, clever, erudite politician with a bit of a dodgy secret, you know, that he's hiding. But he plays this sort of manipulative charm very nicely.
Yes.
I think the problem for me is, you know, right at the end of this first episode, and if you miss the first episode, it's unfortunate that, you know, we're in Ireland so we can't catch up on the iPlayer. But to clue you in, right at the end of the episode, he decides with his sort of his friend, who's another MP by the name of Peter Bessel, who's played by Alex Jennings, who people will know from The Crown, where he played David, Duke of Abdication, whatever.
Duke of
right? And so that he sort of turns to him and says, well, I guess we better kill him then, or something along the lines of that. And I don't, you know, I think this is supposed to be this very chilling moment in the show. And for me, that didn't work at all, because everything else is a joke, a laugh. It's all to be kind of, you know, thrown away very easily. And now it's trying to take this very sharp right turn into dodgy territory that I don't think any of the preceding hour really allowed it to make.
Yeah, it's funny that, because I suppose they don't know exactly, well, you can't know how it happened, so you're taking some imaginative license. Plus, whether it was all as worked out in advance as that, because I have a vague memory of Thorpe being depicted also as something of a tragic character.
I think that's another issue, right? Because obviously, if you are a closeted gay man in Britain in the 1960s, when, and they make it very clear that homosexuality is still illegal, because they go through the some way of explaining how, you know, there's a movement in the parliament to try and decriminalise it, that there he has everything to lose. I mean, he has absolutely everything to lose if this secret comes out. And I almost think it doesn't necessarily, I mean, at one moment you see a sort of a champion of decriminalisation saying he's doing it because his brother had maybe taken his own life or something along the lines of that. And that's really the sort of only indication you get to see of the real peril that these gay men were in, you know, leading these secretive lives, because there were stakes at play here. I don't think it nearly builds up enough the sense that Jeremy Thorpe is on the cusp of losing everything and what that kind of means. Because to me, he was presented as this sort of affable, posh British guy who, you know, it's just water off a duck's back. Like, it doesn't really matter if what would happen, it wouldn't faze him, he'd be fine, kind of thing. Maybe I just misread all of the drama, but to me, it just failed fundamentally to kind of stick that landing.
Well, also as well, when you have dramas about the past, to some degree at least, is supposed to illuminate the present, does it particularly?
It does. I don't, as in, does it illuminate our current...
The age we live in now, yeah. Did it have anything to tell us?
No, I don't think so. No.
It sounds like fortunate. Right, a couple of bits of TV news. The Obamas have signed a production deal with Netflix. Is this where they go around as a crime-fighting team? As like Heart to Heart, but without the whiff of scandal and murder. And
it's the newest, you know, true crime documentary, How the Election Was Stolen. No, it's a unusual turn of events, but seemingly, I guess, this is the power you have when you're the former sort of first couple of the United States. So they have signed some deal for an unspecified amount of money with Netflix. But we need to bear in mind that Netflix is definitely on this charm offensive of moment of contracting big name producers, particularly they have signed Shonda Rhimes of the Shondaverse for $100 million and Ryan Murphy for $300 million. So we don't know what the Obamas are getting, but we do know they signed a deal with Random House Publishing for $65 million for both of their memoirs.
Right.
So we can imagine it's a fair chunk of change anyway. What they're going to do as untrialed TV and movie producers is produce a number of TVs and movies for Netflix over the next couple of years, which will be everything from scripted to non-scripted, which means, you know, TV drama, to documentary films and docuseries. I don't know where this is going to come. The press release is them saying, we've met so many interesting people, we love finding creativity and telling stories, and we want to bring all of that to Netflix. Look, I guess Netflix knows what it's doing, but it's all very strange. What I thought was perhaps the most telling part of this whole thing was Ted Sarandos, who's the head of Netflix, and I really shouldn't have introduced it this way, but rather his wife, anyway, who was the ambassador to the Bahamas during the Obama's first
term. Sweet deal, yeah.
But she's an activist in her own right. I don't want to diminish her, and I really should read out her name just so that doesn't... Nicole Avant is her name. But anyway, they have passed dealings with the Obamas.
Yeah, okay. But the Obamas have zero experience in this area. Like, it's like hiring them to be brain surgeons.
I guess you're hiring their name. I mean,
yeah,
and the sense that people will want to work with them.
Yeah, I suppose, and you know, I suppose Netflix are offering them a huge
truckload
of money, so you know they're not going to say no. Now, is this story connected to the second story you have for us that there's going to be a reboot of Thundercats? Maybe that's why they're getting the Obamas on board.
I can see, you know. Obama or Barack, you know, swinging the Sword of Omens and singing the theme song. So, yeah. So the Thundercats is the latest 1980s, you know, property to be making a reboot. But this is actually its second reboot because it was rebooted in 2011 by Cartoon Network in this original 52 episode plan that was cut in half because it was not a success at all. Because they, you know, if people remember Thundercats, it's most likely Ford's theme song, which is very famously naff. And the cartoon itself is about a bunch of exiled aliens from the planet Thundera who are cats with special powers who do various things against Mumra, a kind of monk slash mummy thing on the planet Third Earth.
Yeah.
And it was brought back as this very po-faced, sort of anime-influenced, you know, regular, straightforward, superhero-y cartoon and completely and utterly tanked. Because cartoons have really moved on a lot since I'd say since... young or older teenagers, they've moved on a lot since then. So it's now coming back as Thundercats Roar in 2019 on the 30th anniversary of the show's original demise. And it's going to be very much influenced by Adventure Time, which if it's kind of a cartoon that people would know. It's one of those that has sort of broken through from childhood into the adult sphere along the lines of like SpongeBob SquarePants and Steven Universe. And it is going to be very wry, a kind of pop animation, but with lots of action, which they say is a throwback to the original show.
So it's kind of like, it's not really for kids, it's kind of like for students.
I would imagine
days
so.
Off and they've taken mushrooms.
Yes,
that kind of thing. Right.
So.
A couple more shows to talk about.
Sam, you don't have to be a slave to the cause, you know. It's bigger than Miko. If you really want to change things, don't protest the town hall.
What are you talking about?
There are some very influential people who want to integrate AP. This protest could send them over the edge.
Integrate AP? I don't know who these people are or what edge they're on.
They've pledged $10 million to the university. They could go towards recruiting students of color.
Troy's got you drinking his Kool-Aid, or rather his daddy's Kool-Aid. So you came to give me a taste. But guess what? I ain't thirsty, girl.
Okay, good to know. Are you sure you wouldn't like a sip? Now, I've never watched Dear White People, so I don't know. But a story with that title, and it's set in a college, and it's all about identity politics. You know, the I imagine ever present danger of broadcasting from inside its own anus is always there.
Yeah, and there is a fair whiff of that throughout the show. Definitely,
that's not a nice whiff. I would have thought.
So what I will say is, if you are the kind of person who is not interested in identity politics, this clearly is not the show for you. What this is by far the best and most interesting teen drama, teen soap opera you could watch, right? And I really mean that in the sense that, you know, there are a lot of shows set in high school and college years that adults watch, right? They're designed specifically for adults and hook teenagers in at the same time. The ones at the moment would be like Riverdale, right?
Yeah.
Which is a sort of, you know, a load of nonsense, right? Now, this is a really interesting and kind of very wry look at identity politics through the lens of race, okay? Mm. And I want to make it very clear that I'm not black and you're not black and, you know, I don't...
No, you've ruined it for everybody. People were assuming I was...
And, you know, I grew up in a very homogenous Ireland and, you know, so a lot of these kind of race issues, I only know as an observer, yeah, having no experience of any of it, right? But I think it is a very interesting look for even just observers at, and I'm going to throw out a social justice term here, sort of black intersectionality, because it presents all of these students on a campus, on a kind of a fictional Harvard-y, Princeton-type, you know, Yale college, and you get all these sort of archetypal black characters, including a mixed-race woman and a gay guy and a sort of typical jock and this son of a Black Panther and all this kind of thing. And it focuses on how sort of class and race and identity come interplaying with each other on the campus. And for a casual, casual observer is not the right word, but for just an observer of what's going on in the race climate in the US, it's very intriguing to sort of be introduced to how, you know, sort of people with paler black skin have an easier way of life than people even with darker black skin and stuff like that. So stuff that I would never have even encountered because it's just not my culture and I have to go digging in order to find it. What else is really, really good about this is it's got incredibly sharply written dialogue that is almost like Sorkin level, you know, witty in its own way, but comes with it as well that sort of all-knowing arch Sorkinism of being holier than thou,
yeah,
right? So you have to take all that with a pinch of salt. But I think what really ties it all very nicely together is how beautifully stylized the show is. It has really gorgeous production values. I mean, it's like, to say it's beautifully lit seems like a really like faint praise, damning, yeah, thing. But actually, it's just, it's really meticulously designed. I started writing my notes kind of like Wes Andersonian in its own way. But actually, I don't want to sort of even lump it in together with that because it's very much its own thing. Mm. But it has a sort of meticulousness on that kind of level where everything is hyper stylized and realized. Also, the episodes are only 30 minutes, which is my favorite thing ever. I love when it's nice and short, yeah, in and out. There's only 10 of them in each season and we're now on to volume 2. And what's interesting about volume 2 is Dear White People began as a feature film of the same name.
Mm.
And season 1, although being, you know, roughly 8 hours longer than the movie, told somewhat of the same story as the movie, which is about a radio show called Dear White People, where a sort of mixed race presenter talks about all of the ills produced by white privilege, and sort of rehashed that again in volume 1. Volume 2 is now its own thing because it's introduced us to all of the characters. We know who they are. It's sort of shed off the whatever remnants are of the movie and even has the two of the movie's stars featuring cameo roles this time around in the TV show. And it is very kind of, it cleverly plays with its own form and is quite reactive to what's going on in America right now, because like one of the sort of burning points of the first episode is that now sort of white nationalists or very conservative Republicans on the campus have started their own rival radio show called Dear Right People. And it's, you know, it plays very cleverly, I think, with its own format. It understands how race and politics and identity and just being a student and wanting, you know, to get laid all come in together.
Yeah.
And it plays and works very well with all of that. I think it is surprisingly much more enjoyable than I was anticipating.
Okay, well, you were anticipating it would be slightly preachy.
Yeah, I was.
And I would always be wrong.
And it is and isn't in its own way. You know, like, I don't think you can produce a perfect piece of entertainment about identity politics because everybody both loathes and loves it at the same time. So it falls under that, you know, caveat. Approach with caution. You need to be the kind of person who is not going to outwardly immediately hate it at first look, because otherwise there's nothing here for you. But if you can get beyond that, I think as a package, it is sort of great teenage melodrama.
Right, okay, we'll move on to our third show of the day. It is My Trans Life. That's on Thursdays at 9:30 a.m. 9:30 p.m. on RT2. You can catch up, of course, on the RT player. Here's a clip.
Last year, Nicky had a hysterectomy and later a double mastectomy. Today, he's back in hospital for a review with the surgeon who performed his mastectomy.
How are you doing?
Great.
Good.
Thank you.
So, it's about, what, 6 months since your surgery?
Yeah.
Yeah, and how's everything?
Brilliant.
Yeah? Any problems, any issues?
There's a bit, like, still tissue that, not, I wouldn't say not happy with, but I prefer it to be a bit flatter, but I know I'm still healing.
So okay. There is still some tissue there that I had to leave behind to keep your nipple alive. That's it. Okay, so that's your pec muscle.
Nicky suffers from gender dysphoria. When in public, the female aspects of his body would cause him stress and anxiety. His double mastectomy has helped to change this.
Now, James, is this a one-off or is it a series of? Because there seems to be a lot of people that they're going to feature in.
Yeah, there are many, many people in it. And I think I just want to start outright by saying many of these people have inter sort of sex names. So if I mislabel anyone with the okay. wrong pronoun, I apologize massively in advance. There is no malice in my intent here. So it's a two-part series. So the first went out last Thursday and the second one is out this evening. And it is a very well put together piece of sort of documentary of human interest storytelling, in the sense that it you get a very good insight into the lives of these trans Irish people, because it takes place over 2 years. So there's a lot going on in that 2 year period. And what's intriguing about it is, I guess, sort of the difference in the way young people choose these days to sort of present their lives versus if they had made this documentary 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago, how different it is, because
it would have been pixelated faces, probably. Yes.
It would have been totally pixelated faces. And the fact is, most of the participants in the programme are already putting themselves out there online anyway. I mean, a couple of them are a sort of a couple, and they have a vlog about their life together.
Right.
And it's on YouTube and you can find all this stuff. So as well as the sort of kind of talking head interview type things and the camera following around, it's interspliced with their own self-produced footage as well, which is just sort of an intriguing aspect for how documentary filmmaking is going to change as the stories sort of begin to age up to where we are now in the world, because everyone has a camera on them all the time, a video camera that can edit at the same time. Now, as for the documentary itself and its subjects, I think it's very intriguing and interesting to see this sort of kind of fluency of talk about gender and identity that people of my generation and above are not as fluent with. And I even see this like in my classroom when I'm teaching, languages now. If I say this is the gender of a noun, the students will say, oh, why are you assuming it's gender, as a joke? But even the fact that they are even making this joke shows an awareness of gender as a thing and whether or not it is a thing,
it's
right?
I know they're a bit joking, but it's an interesting point, actually, when it affects French.
Because it ends in ION, right? Yeah, it's feminine singular. Anyway.
So, unless it doesn't want to end in ION, well then.
True. Now, but a slight criticism that I want to make of the documentary is a certain sameness to it, in the sense that, with the exception of one of the participants, everyone is roughly around the same age. So we'll say a kind of a 5 year, kind of 18 to 23, maybe 25 age gap. So it's a lot of the same kind of story over and over again.
Yeah.
There is one participant who's doing his leaving cert. And that's I don't want to use the word novelty because I don't want to, like, other, but what I mean is it is a different side of the story that we haven't seen before. Whereas with the other participants, you are seeing the same kind of story again and again and again.
Mm.
Now, at the same time, these people are putting themselves out there in a very honest and unflinching way. And it's a very intriguing story to follow, how someone comes to terms with their identity, how, how someone who is born outwardly looking like a boy but feels like a girl, or is a girl, I should say, how going through life she can feel punished by adults who are trying to pigeonhole them and come out of it at the other end having gone through, and will admit to having gone through openly and honestly, gone through therapy and seeing therapy as being just as much an important part as any sort of reassignment surgery, because it's this huge part of your identity, and they really talk through it in this open and honest and intriguing way. I guess I would just be more intrigued to see stories of older people, you know, who've been trans for decades maybe, or 20 years or 5 years or whatever, but just a bit more variety in the storytelling.
Yes, I know what you mean. Did any of them talk about the how long they had to wait to get surgery? Because certainly in Ireland, it that seems to be an issue.
Yeah, it certainly in the documentary, it made clear that there's a very long waiting list to get in to see the various medical professionals who can, I think, diagnose properly the thing. Certainly there was a sense of this takes time, and I can't off the top of my head say if they, you know, they gave, you know, brass tacks figures kind of thing. But what you did see is them seeing their doctors and sort of talking through the various hormonal changes that might happen in their body if they start blocking testosterone or taking estrogen. I'm not an endocrinologist, so bear in mind that. But it certainly portrays the fact that it is a huge process to go through, in the sense that it involves so many steps over a serious period of time, whether that is taking hormones, blocking hormones, going through a surgery, or going through the motions of your family. You know, it really is a huge, huge process, this change, and I thought it was intriguing in that sense.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much for telling us about our shows today. He's not black, he's not an endocrinologist, but he is James Dempsey. James, thanks very much. We'll take a break, back in a sec.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
After this break.